From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two frequent users of the nation's alternative postal system. We talk with writer John Seabrook. He wrote about his adventures with email in last week's New Yorker. Then we talk with Stuart Brand, a founder of The Well, a computer conference system. Also today, struck by lightning. Gretel Ehrlich tells us about the bolt of lightning that stopped her heart, altered her central nervous system, and left her hovering between life and death. Her memoir about the experience and its aftermath is called A Match to the Heart. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews John Secada's new album, Heart, Soul, and a Voice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The warring parties in Bosnia have decided on a one-month ceasefire. United Nations envoy Yasushi Akashi calls this a first step toward bringing an end to the hostilities in the former Yugoslavia. The BBC's Sophie Fisher reports from Geneva.
Mr. Akashi wanted a four-month total cessation of hostilities. What he has achieved is a one-month-long ceasefire starting at midday on Friday. The two sides have agreed that from that time they will undertake no offensive operations or provocative acts of any kind. They have also agreed to release immediately all detainees and exchange information about missing persons. The Muslim Croat side, who have essentially got what they demanded, welcomed the deal, saying it would be a test of the willingness of the Serbs to restart peace talks. However, the Bosnian Serbs' leader, Radovan Karadzic, made it clear he was unhappy with the ceasefire. Mr. Akashi hopes this deal will be a first step towards a more comprehensive ceasefire, which would include the withdrawal of troops and artillery. Negotiations on that should start in Bosnia next week.
Sophie Fisher reporting. The United States and Russia are both investigating why a U.S. transport plane was forced to land by Russian fighter jets yesterday. The Associated Press is quoting a U.S. official who says Washington doesn't believe the initial Russian explanation that the U.S. plane had wandered off course. Russian fighter jets forced the plane to land at Sochi, a city on the Black Sea. It said that the U.S. plane had violated Russian airspace. The crew was allowed to take off again 3 hours later. Israeli jets have again attacked positions of the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon, apparently in retaliation for earlier attacks on what Israel calls its security zone in South Lebanon. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Lebanese security sources say two Israeli jets fired rockets at Hezbollah positions just north of the security zone. An Israeli military spokesman confirmed the attack on a Hezbollah base and said all planes returned safely. Several hours earlier, guerrillas fired Katyusha rockets and mortars into the zone. Air raids have been a standard Israeli response to attacks on the zone, and today's raid did not appear to be directly linked to last week's more serious fighting when Israeli aircraft attacked a Hezbollah base in the Bekaa Valley near the Syrian border, and Hezbollah fired rockets into northern Israel. After that exchange, Israel moved reinforcements to its border with Lebanon and warned it would escalate the fighting if there were more attacks on Israel. So far, there have not been. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Burlington Northern Railroad says two people died today in a train wreck near Thedford, Nebraska. A spokeswoman says they were killed in a wreck involving three coal trains. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 13 points at 37.42. This is NPR. Russia has been welcomed into a new global organization. Moscow has signed a new agreement opening the door to join the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Russia can now receive new economic help and investment. Secretary of State Warren Christopher told a meeting of the OECD today in Paris that should help emerging free market nations around the world. Mexico has also joined the elite group. But Great Britain and Switzerland have complained about this. They say Mexico isn't as developed as other OECD members. Florida's governor and other state officials have granted clemency to more than 100 foreign felons. This clears the way for their deportation. Susan Gage of Florida Public Radio reports.
The deportation plan is an agreement the state reached with the Federal Immigration and Naturalization Service to relieve the burden of keeping foreign criminals in Florida prisons. State corrections officials estimate there are approximately 4,000 foreigners in jail cells across the state. The group granted clemency are those who have agreed to deportation or are under orders to leave the country once they complete their sentences. Florida Governor Lawton Childs.
We're grateful to the Department of Justice, Attorney General Janet Reno, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service for their active cooperation that makes this landmark agreement possible.
The first group of inmates should leave Florida within 30 to 60 days. For National Public Radio, this is Susan Gage in Tallahassee.
German prosecutors say police who didn't step in to stop a neo-Nazi mob that was attacking foreigners last week could face trial. A spokesman says they're looking at whether to press charges against at least one officer. One of the worst anti-foreigner riots occurred last month in Magdeburg. More than 150 neo-Nazis and 200 police officers clashed. This began when some 40 neo-Nazis started looking for foreigners in the city and chased five Africans into a cafe. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For a lot of people, email is better than the post office, better than a phone call. Email is electronic mail sent through a computer network. People use email for everything from business to romance. John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker who only recently started getting and sending email. After publishing a piece about Bill Gates, the head of the software company Microsoft Word, Seabrook was delighted to get lots of email from readers, until he was flamed. A flame is a derogatory or obscene message sent through the email. Getting flamed unnerved Seabrook and prompted him to write a piece about his email adventures called My First Flame, which was published in last week's New Yorker. I asked him to describe that flame.
It was a letter that a very rude message. I'm trying to paraphrase for the radio, and it makes me aware of how different talk is on the internet than talk on the radio. It was a random string of obscene insults, really. I mean, the scatological imagery was almost poetically intense. I mean, it was a rather impressive document. I'm familiar with the guy's work who wrote me The Flame, and I have to say his flame is the best work of his that I've seen. And people are now kind of quoting some of the better lines to me as I kind of go around town. I mean, it's kind of funny now to have the people sort of say these things, but at the time it was quite devastating.
Well, after you got flamed, you called your computer service to complain. What was their reaction?
Well, I didn't call them. I emailed them.
Oh, excuse me. How foolish.
Of course. And I use a commercial service. You pay a subscription. It gives them a little bit more authority over what goes on their system than, you know, a university service might have. And they do try to kind of keep the tone at a certain level. But their response to me was that because this message was a private message and not as opposed to a message that was publicly posted in a forum somewhere, that they had no way of monitoring its content, which I think is probably a good thing because the only way they could monitor the content would be to read your mail or to run keyword searches on words that they find objectionable. And that would turn the thing into kind of a police state. So I don't criticize CompuServe for not deleting the guy's message before it got to me. I was just asking them because I didn't know exactly what their policy was, and they said they couldn't do it, so.
Did you get more email? More flames?
Not from him. I did get a little bit of a broiling back from him when I sent him my reply to his first flame to me. But now, however, now that I have written a piece in which I have talked about how my feelings were hurt in getting flamed, it's kind of open season on me. And people have been very nice. There are many people who have sent me wonderful email messages, and they outnumber the nasty ones, but I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. I mean, people keep saying to me, you're naive. But And the other thing I guess I should say is that when you go online and when you join an electronic community, you can't help but kind of hope that it's going to be a better world, or at least I did. I mean, people join these communities because they're a little lonely in their lives, or they don't have friends, or they don't have a chance to talk about the kinds of issues that they want to talk about because the people who live around them or work around them aren't interested in them. So you get on one of these services and you begin meeting and talking to people who, you know, share your unique interests in whatever it is, you know, in fiddler crabs or in politics or in sex or whatever. And you kind of can't help but start thinking this is kind of a utopia. And then you get flamed and your kind of utopian experience is over, or at least it's made a little bit more realistic. And yet there's a thing in the back, at least in my back of my mind, that you keep wishing that it could be better. I mean, I'm just not quite ready to give up that people can't behave in a slightly more decent manner on the internet than they do in the real world. I'm struggling trying to hold on to that in face of great odds.
Do you have any information on who the person was who sent you your first flame?
Sure, I know who it was.
Oh, you know exactly who it was?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I chose not to publish his name because... partly because, I mean, he never explained why. I mean, if he just explained why, it would have maybe been a lot better. He never kind of explained why he'd sent it. But I thought, well, maybe the guy was drunk or something. This is the other thing about communicating with people over the computer. You don't know if they're drunk or stoned or what's going on when they're talking to you, which even on a telephone, you kind of have a pretty good clue. So you know, maybe he made a terrible mistake, and by publishing his name in the piece, I would kind of damage his career, and you know, I felt like that would have been an even greater flame than the one he sent me, and it just didn't feel like the right thing to do.
Now, you write for The New Yorker, and The New Yorker is one of, or perhaps the best edited magazine in the country. So you're used to editing that passes through many, you're used to writing things that pass through many layers of editing before they're published.
Right.
Now you're writing on email where you're, you know, when you write to someone, there's no editing at all. When they write back to you, of course, there's no editing at all. Have you been interested in watching the language and syntax and stylistics that people use in the email?
It's been fascinating. One of the great things about the internet is because it's really all made out of words. People are constantly inventing new words to... just sort of from the joy of invention, or sometimes they invent acronyms to stand for words because typing is harder than talking. So there are all these sort of stylistic innovations and grammatical innovations, or just sort of lack of grammar and lack of spelling. I think the other great thing is that, or appalling thing, depending on your point of view, is that people don't really need to know how to spell any, and people don't care. I mean, people on the internet don't care whether you spell things correctly for the most part. And a lot of people don't take the trouble to get it right. At any rate, The New Yorker, on the other hand, represents, I think, among all American kind of cultural institutions, it's at the top of representing a sort of a certain kind of a style. It has a certain sort of civility in the way it uses language, and there are all kinds of shibboleths that exist in usage at The New Yorker that have grown up over its 79-year history that are hard to explain, but they exist. As a writer, you kind of encounter these when you use one of these words. Like, for example, if you use the word balding at The New Yorker, the copy editors change it to partially bald. And once I asked about this, and I was told that the reason for it was because Mr. Sean, William Sean, who was the editor of The New Yorker for a long time, thought that the word balding was insensitive because it implied the person was going to go more bald. whereas partially bald, at least, you know, left it open that they weren't going to go any more bald than they are now. So when I was closing this piece on email and on the internet, I kind of had these two cultures smushed up against each other, and we stayed up late into the night trying to figure out all these things about, you know, Well, okay, should we put a dash in online? Should we make database one word or two words? Should we capitalize the E in email, or should we make it a small E? There are all these new words that had never been used in the New Yorker before, and, you know, we didn't know how to deal with them. It was fascinating.
Once you're on the internet, if you're a journalist and you're writing pieces as you are, the feedback not only comes to you on your email, but you could tap into other bulletin boards and see what other people are saying about you. They might be having a conversation about your piece, especially this is true when your piece is about something near and dear to the hearts of people who are signed on, such as email.
Right.
So what's it like for you to read people having a conversation about you instead of speaking directly to you about your work?
It's scary. I sort of feel like sometimes that I've kind of mixed up some weird potion in the basement and taken a drink of it and I'm invisible. I mean, you have this sort of sensation that people are, it's like that fantasy of wanting to go to your own funeral or something like that. People are talking about you in a way that they do in the real world when you're not around, but they never do it when you are around. Because people just don't do that in the real world, but they do it on bulletin boards. For a journalist, it's a very interesting experience. A lot of journalists, I think, particularly people who write for news magazines or magazines like The New Yorker, are kind of cut off from their readers in a way, and they don't get the kind of critical feedback that, you know, like an actor who is on Broadway reads the reviews the next day and, you know, somebody says they're awful. And, I mean, I used to read those reviews and think, my God, how does that person deal with it? It's a new thing for journalists, I think. But like I said before, I think in the long run, I think it's good. If you just can allow it not to crush you. There was a piece in Newsweek a few weeks ago, a cover story about men and women on the internet, and that was really flamed on the well. I mean, worse than my piece, probably. And I talked to the woman who wrote it. She called me on the phone after my piece came out saying, thank you for saying these things. And I think she was really hurt. I mean, really quite hurt. And I think kind of had a lot of trepidation about ever writing about this subject again. I mean, I guess that would be the bad side if journalists start kind of qualifying what they think is the truth because they're afraid of what, you know, people will say about them on a bulletin board. But I don't intend to do that.
John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Coming up, we talk with Stuart Brand, a founder of the computer conference system The Well. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from John Seabrook, a newcomer to computer communications. Stuart Brand is a veteran. He co-founded The Well, a computer conference system which originated in the San Francisco Bay Area and now connects people from around the country. The Well is an acronym for Whole Earth Electronic Link. Brand is also the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. He has a new book called How Buildings Learn, What Happens After They're Built. Stuart Brand told me he's been flamed plenty of times. He says it got particularly bad while he was on the board of The Well. In fact, that's one of the reasons he resigned. He always knew who was sending the obnoxious messages because you have to identify yourself on The Well. In fact, The Well software doesn't allow anonymity. Brand told me why it was designed that way.
I encountered an experience on a system called Eyes back in the early 1980s where a small group of people, very bright corporate and academic people were 30 or 40 of them on a system together and having important discussions about important issues of the day. And anonymity was permitted on Eyes, and one member of that group started to go after other people in a kind of teasing way from a position of anonymity, and it just blew the trust in the group. and we never really got it back. And so that convinced me that anonymity, while really good in principle because it allows whistleblowing and people to tell deeply personal stories and so on, in practice it was always going to be a problem.
Are there other big questions of conduct now on the well and on the internet in general?
I understand that there's the internet is taking off now, kind of the way fax did a few years ago. And the structure is not like a highway, it's like an epidemic. And by, everybody catches it in order to stay in business or to stay current with things going on. And when you have a takeoff like that, you're going to get strange behavior for a while until things sort out.
So what kind of strange behavior are you seeing now as more and more people sign onto the internet?
They get drunk with freedom, and there's always a kind of an intoxication that goes with new tools in new situations where there's not a whole lot of conventions yet about how to do things. And so people find they can insult, or people find that they can invade other discussions, and so they insult and invade.
What are some of the conventions that guide people's behavior now?
If one is flamed, the most sensible thing to do is just let it go, either an email or as a comment in a public conference. Because if you respond, you will inflame the flamer and probably other people as well, and the subject of discussion will just go away.
Mm-hmm. When John Seabrook was flamed, one of his first responses was to call the commercial computer conference system that he belongs to and say, look, this terrible thing happened to me. You got to do something. And their reaction was basically, well, you know, we have open communications. But, you know, call us if it happens again. But there isn't a way of punishing somebody's behavior or preventing such mail from getting sent. Do you think there should be? Or do you think that would be a big mistake?
Most of these things are correctable either in the human social interaction where you agree on certain forms of behavior, or they're correctable by having different pockets. For example, on the well, there's a couple of hundred different conferences, and each conference will typically have its own standards of behavior. So, for example, there's a writer's conference in which people are constantly kind to each other. Writers are so vulnerable, especially while they're writing, they realize that this could only be done in a non-critical atmosphere. Other conferences are fierce and wild, and if you go there, that's what you expect to find. So that's one solution. Another solution is in the software. If you forbid anonymity, you get different behavior. If you allow it, you get different behavior. You can have what are called bozo filters, where if there's someone who just irks you every time you see a posting from them, you can arrange so that you never see their postings.
Now, how did you co-found The Well? What was the principle behind it?
The Well was offered to me as a set of half-baked software and a little bit of money in a VAX back in 1984. VAX was a mini computer at the time. And having had experience with other systems, what I thought we should probably do is try having a regional system without anonymity. And the main thing with these systems is the initial state. And so what we did is brought in people who were primarily either hackers or journalists or writers. The hackers, because we needed them to help make the system work and to help defend it. Writers, because they could write well and would bring a level of discourse that would inform everything. And also having journalists have free accounts was our entire marketing strategy.
That's interesting. And did the strategy work?
Brilliantly. I mean, it was no other system gets so much ink still.
And what about the level of discourse, having brought on all those writers at the start?
It's amazing. You could actually see people becoming writers on the well and on other systems, because there they are. They're having to communicate in a very compressed form, because people won't typically read more than one screen at a time, and just by writing and reading. And people started writing well, and other people would value what they'd written and ask if they could use it in some publication, and pretty soon they're getting paid to write in publications, and we saw a number of professional writers come into existence on the well and elsewhere.
You were part of the the pranksters, the group of people who traveled on the bus with Ken Kesey and so on in the 1960s, really important group in the hippie subculture of the 60s. Then you moved on, did the Whole Earth Catalog, and then became very important in the computer culture. And I wonder if you see any comparisons between the utopian visions of the hippie subculture of the 60s and of the computer subculture that developed in the 80s.
It's not a question of parallels. They're the same thing. The at least the hackers who really made the personal computer revolution happen were part of the counterculture. They started at MIT in 1961 and continued right through the 60s and 70s as a very quiet, busy part of the counterculture, creating what turned out to be the only revolution that we really succeeded with.
That's how you see it?
Oh, that's absolutely how I see it. And not only that, it was intentional.
What do you mean?
The personal computer creators wanted to overcome the central mainframe approach to life, and IBM in particular, and they did.
Well, one of the things you use your computer for is to write and design books, and you have a new book called How Buildings Learn that you told me before you actually did on your computer. And tell me about this concept of buildings learning. What do you mean about a building learning?
Well, a peculiarity of buildings is I think it's almost the only major thing that people make that can keep getting better through time,
mm-hmm.
indefinitely, infinitely. But very few buildings actually do that. And early on, six, 7 years ago, I started paying attention to brand new buildings designed by famous architects at vast sums of money that just didn't work at all and couldn't work, couldn't be fixed. And so I started looking at what's that actually made of, what are the problems there, and what kind of buildings do get better over time. And it turned out to be an area that hadn't been looked at, so I spent 6 years studying buildings over time and finding out that it's possible to really work with time in buildings and that there's some principles that you can draw on how to do that.
Now, you live on a houseboat, right?
You bet. I'm on a 1912 tugboat.
So how has your boat been adapted over the years?
It was originally actually a two-masted schooner when it was built in 1912, and then in the 1930s it was probably a hulk, and somebody got the hull and put a tugboat house on it and ran it as a tugboat and a fishing boat for a number of years. And then it was hulked again in San Francisco Bay when my wife and I got it 12 years ago, and then we converted it into a houseboat. And it's pretty interesting. This is the basic preservation story. Preservationists are always taking buildings that were built for one thing and turning them into another use, and that always turns out to release a lot of creativity and innovation, and it's one of the reasons that I think preservation has been such a major success.
What do you like about living on a houseboat?
Well, houseboats have, in a way, it's similar to the well. You're in a very intense community, but because you're surrounded by water, there's also a feeling of great privacy. I mean, you hear the neighbors argue, and you even hear what they're arguing about, but somehow you're not in each other's, stuck in each other's space the way you are in, say, in an apartment building.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart Brand, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stuart Brand is a founder of The Well, a computer conference system, and the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. His new book is called How Buildings Learn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Three summers ago, while walking on the Wyoming plains in a storm, Gretel Ehrlich was struck by lightning. The force of it threw her 40 feet, severely damaged her nervous system, and nearly killed her. We'll talk with her about the psychological and physical aftermath. It's the subject of her new memoir, A Match to the Heart. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Heart, Soul, and a Voice, the new album by John Secada. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The South Korean president says sanctions are the only option against North Korea. The South wants to pressure the North to allow international nuclear weapons inspection. But China, a North Korean ally, wants a diplomatic solution instead. The BBC's Jonathan Burchell reports.
As South Korea's foreign minister Han Sung-joo headed for Beijing, President Kim Il-sung said in Seoul that the South now has no choice but to press for sanctions against North Korea. But China wants more diplomacy. Foreign Minister Chen Chi-chun was quoted in the official media as saying that sanctions would only aggravate the crisis. The Chinese are proposing talks between both Koreas, Washington, and the International Atomic Energy Agency over the crisis. China supplies North Korea with 80% of its oil. For economic sanctions to be successful, its support would be vital. But Beijing has an increasingly close relationship with South Korea, too. And China, too, would feel threatened if either of the two Koreas acquired nuclear weapons.
Jonathan Burchell reporting. The North Korean foreign minister has announced his country is ready for inspections, but it demands that high-level talks with the United States be first revived. The United States has rejected this demand. The Clinton administration's special advisor on Haiti went to Capitol Hill today. Former Congressman and special envoy Bill Gray says a U.S. invasion of Haiti is not imminent. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
The president's special advisor on Haiti, Bill Gray, made clear that the United States may well invade Haiti if the military dictators don't quit. But under questioning by Chairman Hamilton of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Gray said no such invasion is imminent.
Is a military intervention in Haiti imminent?
Mr. Chairman, the president has not ruled out any option.
He said a UN task force is being set up to go into Haiti after the military junta is gone to try to keep the peace and let exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide rule Haiti. No cost estimates were advanced, but congressmen made clear they want to know what the invasion and peacekeeping would cost. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The Organization of American States has banned all commercial flights to and from Haiti. The group has also agreed to ban any financial transaction with the Caribbean nation. The resolutions were agreed to yesterday in an OAS meeting in Brazil. An employee buyout plan of United Airlines could be in trouble. The buyout plan's second largest shareholder says it will vote against the deal. The manager of Vanguard Windsor Mutual Funds is agreeing with worries that other investors are talking about. The stockholders are unhappy with a change in the terms of the buyout that has raised the employee stake to 55%. That concession was given to try to win over the pilots' union. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 6 points to end the day at 3,749. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Primary election results from five states that held races for governor are in. Californian Kathleen Brown coasted to victory in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. She hopes to unseat Governor Pete Wilson in November, who defeated his opponent, Ron Unz. Brown is the sister and daughter of former governors Jerry and Pat Brown. South Dakota's Republican governor, Walter Miller, was crushed by former GOP governor Bill Janklow. Iowa Republican Governor Terry Branstad survived a tight primary contest with former actor and GOP Representative Fred Grandy. Branstad will face State Attorney General and Democrat Bonnie Campbell. And Alabama Governor and Democrat Jim Folsom is leading Democratic opponent Paul Hubbard. 1,700 United Auto Workers are staging a strike at an Illinois Caterpillar plant. It's the ninth walkout since September. Tony Sarabia of member station WBEZ has this report.
The union has used short, isolated strikes to halt production at the earth-moving equipment plant in Montgomery since a dispute over its contract began more than 2 years ago. Yesterday's walkout prompted the company to draft salaried and management workers into the factory to assemble excavators and wheel loaders, some of the company's top items. A union official says the latest strike erupted after four UAW members were suspended for refusing to remove slogans on picket signs displayed on their personal property inside the plant. However, Caterpillar spokesman Keith Butterfield says the signs were not the issue, saying it's the inappropriate display of the slogans. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
Rescue workers in Colombia are still looking through rocks and debris for victims of Monday's earthquake and avalanche. At least 100 people are known dead. Authorities say another 150 people are missing after the quake triggered the landslide into the village of Toez. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was an awful thunderstorm Monday evening in Philadelphia. I was caught on the expressway. As I inched along in my car, watching some vivid lightning, I thought about my next guest, Gretel Ehrlich. She was struck by lightning on her Wyoming ranch during a storm 3 summers ago. She was knocked unconscious and nearly died. Her new memoir, A Match to the Heart, chronicles the physical, psychological, and emotional aftereffects of the electric current that passed through her body. Ehrlich now lives in California, where she grew up. She's best known for her essays and short stories about life in Wyoming, where she lived for much of the 70s and 80s, herding sheep and cattle. Her books include The Solace of Open Spaces and Islands, the Universe, Home. Here's a reading from the opening of her new memoir, A Match to the Heart.
I woke in a pool of blood lying on my stomach some distance from where I should have been, flung at an odd angle to one side of the dirt path. The whole sky had grown dark. Was it evening, and if so, which one? How many minutes or hours had elapsed since I lost consciousness, and where were the dogs? I tried to call out to them, but my voice didn't work. The muscles in my throat were paralyzed, and I couldn't swallow. Were the dogs dead? Everything was terribly wrong. I had trouble seeing, talking, breathing, and I couldn't move my legs or right arm. Nothing remained in my memory. No sounds, flashes, smells, no warnings of any kind. Had I been shot in the back? Had I suffered a stroke or a heart attack? These thoughts were dark pools in sand. The sky was black. Was this a storm in the middle of the day, or was it night with a storm traveling through? When thunder exploded over me, I knew I had been hit by lightning.
Gretel Ehrlich, how did you know you were hit by lightning?
Well, I didn't at first. It was really just after I'd been lying there for a while. And I at first thought I was going to die, and then I didn't die. And then this storm kind of circled around and came over the mountain and really pounded hard, and there was lightning everywhere. And then it finally occurred to me that that's what must have happened to me.
And why did you think that? I know, sure, there was a storm, but why did you think that that made sense, that what you were experiencing was the symptoms of being hit by lightning?
Well, I was paralyzed, although at first I thought maybe I'd been shot in the back, but paralysis comes when you're hit by lightning because your muscles contract so violently. And I had crushing chest pains, but, I really didn't think I was a heart attack victim. So I just thought that must have been it.
You woke up in a pool of blood. Where was the blood coming from?
My head. When you're hit by lightning, this is the only thing I wish I had seen happen. Your muscles contract so violently that you literally fly through the air. So, you know, like a big explosion. So I flew somewhere. It's like the flying nun. So I just hit my head on some rocks, and I had some cuts on my face. And, you know, they bleed more than is really... I mean, I wasn't injured very badly, but there was a lot of blood around.
When you awoke, you couldn't tell if you were dead or alive for a moment there?
Well, I thought I was dead, but if I was dead, how did I know I was dead? So I guess that meant I was alive.
Would you describe the feeling of being feeling in between?
Yeah, it's this kind of gray area, not very attractive, not... You know, you keep hearing these stories of this great sense of peace comes over you. And I didn't feel any peace at all. I just felt that I was someplace that had no juiciness, no vividness, no brightness, no vitality left to it. It had all been stripped away. And I had no self, in a way, no identity and no volition. And it was a very oppressive feeling.
You did manage to summon up enough strength and willpower to get yourself back to your house, which is about a quarter of a mile away from where you were struck by lightning.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been awfully hard to do.
Well, I was lying there for a while and thinking I was going to die, so I was trying to clear my mind and just, you know, not be panicky and let it happen. And then it didn't happen, and then I got mad. I thought, oh, now I have to go get help, which seemed like a much worse prospect at the moment. But I did. I knew, you know, if I stayed out there, I was probably going to die of exposure, because by then it was raining hard, it was getting cold, and nobody would ever, you know, nobody would have found me for maybe days, weeks, months. So I knew I had to do something. There was really no choice unless I actually chose to die, which suddenly I didn't want to do. So I just got up.
Well, you had a couple of bad hospital experiences early on where equipment didn't work and the doctors really didn't know what to do with you. But then you went to a larger hospital and had a cardiologist who became, I think, a friend as well as a doctor. What did you learn about the body's electrochemical operation and how that's affected by the disruption of lightning?
Yeah, well, in my case, I had a brainstem injury, which affects the autonomic nervous system and my sympathetic nervous system, which is the part that sort of gives your body the get up and go. It tells your heart to beat. It controls blood pressure. It releases the neurotransmitters that tell the blood vessels to constrict or not to constrict. That whole operation was completely fried, and just didn't work. So I just my heart kept beating because, you know, it has this internal pacemaker, a kind of natural pacemaker that makes the heart want to beat. But that was about all that was keeping me going. So I learned a lot about, I mean, that you can't learn anything about the body without also thinking about the brain and the chemical architecture of the brain. So I did a lot of reading in both areas.
Would you mind just doing a quick inventory for us about how different parts of your body were affected by the lightning?
Yeah, well, at first I was paralyzed from the waist down and down my right arm, and my throat was paralyzed, my throat muscles, so I couldn't swallow or talk. So then I had, you know, external bruises and cuts and things. But then the interior effects were just the whole sympathetic nervous system. They say that when lightning enters you, you have sympathetic storms. It's like really ingesting a whole storm in your body. And it literally burned the passageways through which the brain, the neurotransmitters, which are little drops of chemicals, it destroyed those highways in my body, so that all those cells had to, they think cells are covered with this kind of sheath that protects it, and they think that actually melted. So all of that had to be repaired.
My guest is Gretel Ehrlich. Her new memoir, A Match to the Heart, is about being struck by lightning. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gretel Ehrlich. We all know the expression, lightning never strikes twice in the same place. But in fact, you were hit twice by lightning, which is really shocking to me. The first time, I think it wasn't a direct hit. You were riding on a horse and the horse was hit?
Yeah, it was lightning that was coming across a little meadow at a very high altitude, just going across the ground, and it came up through my horse's legs and up through my legs. You know, the horse had shoes on and I had spurs on, and this big spark bounced off the top of my head. But that's, you know, that's all that happened.
What do you make of it that you were struck twice?
Oh, well, a lot of people have been struck twice. I'm outside a lot, you know, really much more than a lot of people. But, you know, ranchers, farmers, fishermen, people like that are golfers, often get struck more than once. I think Lee Trevino's been struck a couple of times. And so it's just really an occupational hazard, especially if you live in a mountainous area, you know, where there's afternoon thunderstorms or say, like Florida has a lot of lightning strikes.
So you think it has more to do with people who are out in big open spaces during storms?
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't feel like you were...
And out all day.
So you didn't feel like you were being targeted by the forces of nature?
Oh, not at all. Quite the opposite. I just think it's part of, you know, living in the natural world. Things happen to you.
After you were struck by lightning, you were sick for months afterwards, and you needed someone to take care of you. For a while, your parents took care of you. And your parents, when you were hit, were 75. What did it feel like to be their child again, to be taken care of by them again?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I hadn't spent a whole lot of time with my parents for a very long time. And when I called them from Wyoming and said I needed help and I didn't think I was going to make it through the night, and my father said, I'll be there in 4 hours, and went and found a friend who had a plane and came and got me, and I ended up on the cardiac care unit, and then was released to their house after a week in intensive care. And you know what happened was, I mean, they were in the room when my heart was almost stopped beating, and I had no blood pressure. And when they got me going again, and I opened my eyes, I couldn't talk or move, but my mother was stroking my arm, and we just looked at each other, and at that moment, any of the problems or whatever that goes on between parents and children for many years just really went away. And ever since then, we've been very, very close. And, you know, in a certain way, they were the only people in the world besides my doctor who I knew would understand when I really needed help, even if I was unable to tell them. I mean, because they know me so well, they could just look at my face and know, and were really available to help me. So it was quite wonderful, and it engendered a new friendship between us, which has been great for both of us. And so now we take turns taking care of each other. Now they're almost 80, and they need some help, and sometimes I need some help. So it's been really good.
So you live near each other now?
Well, I now live about 50 miles away, but near enough.
That's pretty close by modern standards.
Yeah.
You went to a conference for people who've been struck by lightning. It's called the Lightning Strike and Electric Shock Conference. I believe it was founded in 1989 by a man who had been struck by lightning. Were there things that surprised you that other people experienced that you'd experienced too?
Yeah, it was quite comforting to find that there was a sameness in some of the less tangible problems that I was having. Things that, you know, my cardiologist couldn't figure out, which was lots of chest pain, but no apparent reason for it, and lots of kind of random pain, lots of really deep fatigue, you know, unlike anything I've ever experienced before. So, and it turns out that everybody has those same problems, and it was quite common. And the neurologist that was there, explained sort of what he felt was going on. And so, in that way, it was quite interesting. And you know, it was sort of interesting talking to other people who had been hit by lightning, and it also involved people who've been electrocuted somehow, like linemen and, you know, people who hit a light switch that's not grounded properly. And actually, their injuries are much more serious in general.
Why are they more serious than lightning?
Well, usually because it's the electricity, it stays in your body longer. Say a lineman who gets stuck on a transformer, you know, sometimes they're up there for minutes and minutes and minutes, and it's very, very damaging. Also, they remember it. See, anyone hit directly by lightning doesn't remember it, and so I was spared that trauma of remembering what I'm sure is very painful. And the electrocuted people remember everything, and they have a lot of psychological damage that they have to deal with. So,
you know, most of your writing in the past has been about nature, about open spaces, about living in Wyoming, about place and geography, and so on. And it seems to me in your new book, you're looking at your body and the body in general with the same kind of awe that you used to examine the landscape with.
Yeah, well, you know, what I discovered is this great, the body is this great ecosystem all in itself. And I mean, it is really a miraculous place. Our bodies themselves are more complex than our imaginations. So I think it's, it was really like a whole nother landscape, or I call it in the book, I call it an organscape.
Gretel Ehrlich, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gretel Ehrlich's new memoir is called A Match to the Heart. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be catching up on yesterday's primary election results from around the country. We'll also be hearing from Bob Woodward today, author of The Agenda. His latest book is about the Clinton administration's development of an economic program last year and how it got it through Congress, and how in the process, President Clinton became more the Washington insider concerned with the bond markets than the populist running for president on behalf of people who work hard and play by the rules, as he used to say. Also today, a talk with Toby Twining of the Toby Twining Music Quartet, who has a new CD out called Shaman.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Secada's debut album, released in 1992, sold more than 6 million copies and instantly established him as a new pop idol for fans of adult contemporary music. Although rock critic Ken Tucker doesn't usually have much tolerance for such middle-of-the-road fare, he finds Secada's new album, Heart, Soul, and a Voice, irresistible.
Taking a day at a time. Feelings I don't wanna hide. Turn into love as I go, baby. Without taking you long for a ride.
Never underestimate the power of sincerity. Where John Secada's first album was a collection of shrewdly calculated pop and adult contemporary songs, Heart, Soul, and a Voice sounds like Secada's earnest attempt to reposition himself as a state-of-the-art rhythm and blues singer, to invoke older musical styles that have meant a lot to him, and to add something original to them. Over the course of this album, Secada is casting himself as a boyish, vulnerable romantic in the tradition of Smokey Robinson and Al Green. When his music is most full of itself, he's more like Daryl Hall with slightly less self-consciousness. And even at his most overwrought, Secada is Michael Bolton with soul, which automatically makes him 20 times more valuable than Bolton himself. And I'd be surprised if you don't hear the influence of Marvin Gaye on Good Feelings.
Yeah.
Cicada was born in Cuba and is a former backup singer for Gloria Estefan. He's as warm and spontaneous sounding as Estefan is chilly and formal. Like a lot of pop singers, Cicada doesn't have much faith in words to express what he's feeling. He's content to mouth lyrics that are blithe cliches. He gets his best effects from altering the grain of his voice slightly, or by lengthening or shortening the sounds of words to give them emotional weight that they don't otherwise possess. That's the reason why one of the most expressive tunes on Heart is La La La, a deliriously effective love song built around those three nonsense syllables, plus a catchphrase borrowed from, of all people, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Ultimately, John Cicada isn't in the same class as the vocalists he emulates here. He's great at hoarse exhortations. His voice is vibrant and piercing, but you can't say it has much range. As pure and natural as the music sounds, Heart is also a very shrewd collection. If we can't underestimate Cicada's sincerity, neither should we ignore the allure of meticulous schlock. And if the lushness of Cicada's pop soul music is frequently overripe, it's still a juicy pleasure.
Ken Tucker writes about pop culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Jewel Bracey. Our interns are Ann Neville, Philo Holland, and Mark Tullis. I'm Terry Gross.
I can't believe I still need you, and that you feel the
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
1 year ago, Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey had a heart and liver transplant. On the next Fresh Air, the governor reflects on his life-saving transplants and whether they affected his controversial views on abortion and the death penalty. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.